They give us choices and keep us informed on the important holidays. How would you know it was Halloween or Valentine's Day or Mother's Day early enough to do something about it if merchants didn't stay on the job? The other group I count on is kindergarten teachers. They always know about holidays. And when it comes to Valentine's and other evidence of love, no merchant can compete with them. What the kindergarten teacher set in motion, no merchant could sell. It's beyond price. You can't get it at the store in the first place. What I'm talking about here is something I think of as the gummy lump. Once it was a shoebox, decorated and given to me by the oldest child, and then it became a repository of other relics of childhood given to me by the younger children. The shoebox became my treasure chest in time. Its components are standard, three colors of construction paper, pink and white and red, faded now, aluminum foil, orange tissue paper, several paper doilies, three kinds of macaroni, gumdrops, jelly beans, some little white hearts, the kind that taste like Tums, with words on them, and the whole thing held together with a whole big lot of white library paste, which also tastes like Tums. Anyhow, this shoebox isn't looking too very good now. It's a little shriveled and kind of moldy where the jelly beans and the gumdrops have run together. It's still sticky in places after all these years, and most of it is more beige than red and white. If you lift the lid, however, you will begin to know what makes me keep it. On folded and faded fragile pieces of large-lined school paper there are words. Hi, Daddy. And floppy Valentine, and I love you. A whole lot of I love you. Glued to the bottom of the box are 23 X's and O's made out of macaroni. I've counted them more than once. And also scrawled in several places are the names of three children. The treasures of King Tut are nothing in the face of this. Have you got something around the house like a gummy lump? Evidence of love in its most uncomplicated and most trustworthy state? You may live a long time. You may receive gifts of great value and beauty. You may experience much love, but you will never believe in it quite as much as you believe in the gummy lump. It makes your world go around and the ride worth the trouble. The three children are grown up now. They still love me, though it's harder sometimes to get direct evidence. And it's love that's complicated by age and knowledge and confusing values. Love, to be sure, but not simple. Not something you could put in a shoebox. This sticky icon sits on a shelf at the top of my closet. Nobody else knows it's there, but I do. It is a talisman, a kind of cairn to memory, and I think about it almost every morning as I dress. Once in a while, I take it down from the shelf and open it. It's something I can touch and hold and believe in, especially when love gets difficult and there are no small arms around my neck anymore. Oh, sure, this is the worst kind of simple-minded, heart-rending daddy drivel imaginable. I've probably embarrassed us both by telling you, but it beats the hell out of a mood ring or a mantra or a rabbit's foot when it comes to comfort, believe me. And I have no apology. The gummy lump stands for my kind of love. Bury it with me. I want to take it with me as far as I go. Speaking of unique love, this next essay is about Mother Teresa. She died in 1997, and this essay was written 20 years ago. I removed it from the new manuscript, thinking the sentiments were shopworn and the events out of date and Mother Teresa a fading memory. So you may well ask, well, why is it included here? Seeing it in the reject pile troubled me. I read it several times again, and I realized the essay was not about Mother Teresa so much as it was about me and all those like me who try to resolve the inner conflict between self-interest and self-sacrifice. Trying to care about me and care about them and care about us at the same time is an ongoing bewilderment. So I put it back in this anniversary edition of Kindergarten. There was this person who profoundly disturbed my peace of mind for a long time. She didn't know me, but she went around minding my business. We had very little in common. She was an old woman, an Albanian who grew up in Yugoslavia. She was a Roman Catholic nun who lived in poverty in India most of her life. I disagreed with her on fundamental issues of population control, the place of women in the world and in the church, and I was turned off by her naive statements about what God wants. People who claim to speak for God do more harm than good, if you ask me. And she and her followers drove me crazy. They seemed so pious, so self-righteous. I got upset every time I heard her name or read her words or saw her face. I didn't even want to talk about her. Who the hell did she think she was, anyhow? However, in the studio where I used to work and teach, there was a sink. Above the sink was a mirror. I stopped at this place several times each day to tidy up and look at myself in the mirror. Alongside the mirror was a photograph of that troublesome old woman. Each time I looked in the mirror at myself, I also looked at her face. In it I have seen more than I can tell, and from what I saw I understood more than I can say. It's simply that I could not get her out of my mind or life. That particular photograph beside my mirror was taken in Oslo, Norway, on the 10th of December in 1980. This is what happened there. The small, stooped woman in a faded blue and white sari and worn sandals received an award from the hand of a king. An award funded from the will of the inventor of dynamite. In a great glittering hall of velvet and gold and crystal, surrounded by the noble and famous in formal black tie and elegant gowns, the rich, the powerful, the brilliant, the talented of the world in attendance, and there, at the center of it all, this little old lady in a sari and sandals, Mother Teresa of India, servant of the poor and sick and dying, to her, the Nobel Peace Prize. She was given the longest standing ovation in the history of the prize. No president or king or general or scientist or pope or banker or merchant or cartel or oil company or Ayatollah holds the key to as much power as she had. None is as rich. Hers was the priceless, invincible weapon against the evils of this earth, the caring heart. And hers were the everlasting riches of this life, the wealth of the compassionate spirit. Now, I would not do what she did, or do it the way she did it, but her presence on the stage of the world dares me to explain just what the hell I will do then, and how, and when. Several years after she won the Nobel Prize, when I was attending a grand conference of quantum physicists and religious mystics at the Oberoi Towers Hotel in Bombay, I saw her in person. Standing by the door at the rear of the hall, I sensed a presence beside me, and there she was. Alone, this tiny woman had come to speak to this great conference as its guest. When introduced, she strode to the rostrum and changed the agenda of the conference from intellectual inquiry to moral activism. She said, in a firm voice to the awed assembly, "We can do no great things, only many small things with great love." The contradictions of her life and faith are nothing compared to my own. wrestle with frustration about the impotence of the individual, she went right on affecting the world. While I wish for more power and resources, she used her power and resources to do what she could do at the moment. Gandhi would have approved of Mother Teresa. He had some strange ways and habits of his own, but he did what he did. So Mother Teresa disturbed me, inspired me, and still does. What did she have that I do not? If ever there is truly peace on earth, goodwill to men, it will be because of women like Mother Teresa. In watching the millions of women marching in the streets of the world this winter, I was reminded that peace is not something you wish for. It is something you make, something you do, something you are, and something you give away. And you begin with what you have, where you are, and pass it on. Mother Teresa's dead now, of course. Would you have wanted me to omit this essay just because she's gone? Or leave it out of the book because I can't settle my own mind about me and them and us? That is the point, isn't it? What she was and stood for is not out of date or worn out. It lives on as a challenge, not in her, in me, in you, in us. This essay is called Census. There is a clay tablet in the British Museum that's dated about 3800 BC. It's Babylonian. A census report, a people count to determine tax revenues. The Egyptians and the Romans conducted census counts, and there's William the Conqueror's famous Domesday Book, compiled in England in 1085. This need to know how many of us there are is old business. In our own country, the census dates from 1790. Counting people tells some interesting things, especially since computers enable us to extrapolate trends into the future. Take this, for example. If the population of the earth were to increase at the present rate indefinitely, by AD 3530, the total mass of human flesh and blood would equal the mass of the earth, and by AD 6826, the total mass of human flesh and blood would equal the mass of the known universe. That's, of course, if we were to increase at the present rate indefinitely. It boggles the mind, doesn't it? That's a lot of meat. Or consider this one. The total population of the earth at the time of Julius Caesar was 150 million. The population increase in 2 years on earth today is 150 million. Or bring it down into a smaller chunk. In the time it takes me to read this, about 500 people will die and about 680 people will be born. That's about 2 minutes worth of life and death. The statisticians figure that about 70 billion people have been born so far, and as I said, there's no telling how many more there will be, but it looks like a lot. And yet, and here comes the statistic of statistics, with all the possibilities for variation among the sex cells produced by each person's parents, it seems quite certain that each one of the billions of human beings who has ever existed has been distinctly different from every other human being, and that this will continue for the indefinite future. In other words, if you were to line up on one side of the earth every human being who have ever lived or ever will live, and you took a good look at the whole motley crowd, you wouldn't find anybody exactly like you. Now wait, there's more. If you were to line up on the other side of the earth every other living thing that ever was or ever will be, you'd find that the creatures on the people side would be more like you than anything over on the other side. And finally this. There was a famous French criminologist named Émile Locard, and 70 years ago he came up with something called Locard's exchange principle. It says something to the effect that any person passing through a room will unknowingly deposit something there and take something away. Modern technology proves it. Dandruff, a hair, a fingerprint, things like that remain behind. Fulgham's exchange principle extends Locard's thinking. Every person passing through this life will unknowingly leave something and take something away, and most of this something cannot be seen or heard or numbered or scientifically detected or counted. It's what we leave in the minds and hearts of other people and what they leave in ours. Memory. The census doesn't count it. Nothing counts without it. And now, something to pass on. In an essay entitled, Pass It On. V.P. Menon was a significant political figure in India during its struggle for independence from Britain after World War II. He was the highest-ranking Indian in the viceregal establishment, and it was to him that Lord Mountbatten turned for the final drafting of the Charter Plan for Independence. Unlike most of the leaders of the independence movement, Menon was a rarity. A self-made man, no degree from Oxford or Cambridge graced his office walls, and he had no caste or family ties to support his ambitions. Eldest son of 12 children, he quit school at 13 and worked as a laborer, coal miner, factory hand, merchant, and schoolteacher. He talked his way into a job as a clerk in the Indian administration, and his rise was meteoric. Largely because of his integrity and brilliant skills in working with both Indian and British officials in a productive way. Both Nehru and Mountbatten mentioned his name with highest praise as one who made practical freedom possible for his country. Two characteristics stood out as particularly memorable, a kind of aloof impersonal efficiency and a reputation for personal charity. His daughter explained the background of this latter trait after he died. When Menon arrived in Delhi to seek a job in government, all his possessions, including his money and ID, were stolen at the railway station. He would have had to return home on foot, defeated. In desperation, he turned to an elderly Sikh, explained his troubles, and asked for a temporary loan of 15 rupees to tide him over until he could get a job. The Sikh gave him the money, and when Menon asked for his address so he could repay the man, the Sikh said that Menon owed the debt to any stranger who came to him in need as long as he lived. The help came from a stranger and was to be repaid to a stranger. And so Menon never forgot that debt, neither the gift of trust nor the 15 rupees. His daughter said that the day before Menon died, a beggar came to the family home in Bangalore asking for help to buy new sandals, for his feet were covered with sores. Menon asked his daughter to take 15 rupees out of his wallet to give to the man. It was Menon's last conscious act, the repayment of the debt to a stranger. Now, this story was told to me by a man whose name I do not know. He was standing beside me in the Bombay airport at the left luggage counter. I had come to reclaim my bags and had no Indian currency left. The agent would not take a traveler's check, and I was uncertain about getting my luggage and making my plane. The unknown man beside me paid my claim check fee, about 80 cents, and told me this story I just told you as a way of refusing my attempt to figure out how to repay him. His father had been Menon's assistant and had learned Menon's charitable ways and passed them on to his son. And that son had continued the tradition of seeing himself in debt to strangers whenever and however. Nice. From a nameless Sikh to an Indian civil servant to his assistant to his son to me, a white foreigner in a moment of frustrating inconvenience. The gifts were not large as money goes. My need was not great, but the spirit of the gift is beyond price and left me blessed and in debt. Now, on several occasions, when I have thought about the biblical story of the Good Samaritan, I have wondered about the rest of the story. What effect did the charity have on the man who was robbed and beaten and taken care of by the Good Samaritan? Did he remember the cruelty of the robbers and shape his life with that memory? Or did he remember the nameless generosity of the Samaritan and shape his life with that debt? What did he pass on to the strangers in his life, those in need he met? Over the years, readers have passed on many variations of this story to me. Some are autobiographical, it happened to them. And some give credit to many different famous personages. What's true? Even professional fact-checkers aren't really sure. But at least these three things are certain. Our belief in the necessity of the generosity at the heart of Menon's story. Our shared capacity to be part of the chain of generosity, and our belief in the enduring power of the simple, compassionate gesture. We want these things to be true, and they are. Let me move now to an essay entitled Stargazing. We have become catalog junkies, my sweet wife and I. Once you are on one list, you get them all, especially in autumn. They choke the mailbox, and we dutifully leaf through them by the fire after supper, amazed at all the neat stuff we don't have and never knew existed. It feels like the days of my childhood, when the latest Sears Roebuck catalog showed up to fuel the flames of desire for more stuff. My wife asked me, what do I not have that I really want? I didn't tell her everything that came to mind, but once I set aside the more ludicrous notions involving lust, gluttony, and wanton greed, the discussion turned in a more meaningful direction. What do I want? Well, I'd like to be able to see the world through somebody else's mind and eyes for just one day. To be inside and know what I know and see what they see and think at the same time. What do I want? Well, there's a morning in the summer of 1984 I'd like to live over just exactly as it was. I'd like to speak a foreign language well enough to get the jokes. I'd like to talk with Socrates and watch Michelangelo sculpt and paint. I'd like to be able to tap dance really well. I'd like to see the world as it was a million years ago and a million years from now. And so on and so forth. Well, you get the drift of the conversation. We had a great talk well into the night, and none of what we really wanted could be had from catalogs. These were desires made out of nostalgia and imagination packed in the boxes that dreams come out of. Most of all, I'd like to have a living grandfather. Both of mine are mysteries to me. My father's father was shot to death in a saloon in Texas in 1919, and in the same year, my mother's father just walked out of the house one morning on his way to work and never came back, and I still don't know why, and those who do know don't say. In the fairy tale factory in my mind, I imagine that if I had a grandfather, he'd be old and wise and truly grand. A bit of the philosopher, a bit of the magician, and something of a shaman. If I had a grandfather, the one I would most like to have, he would have called me up and asked me if I had heard the news about the photograph of the latest solar system existing around a star twice as big and 10 times as bright as our own sun, a star named Beta Pictoris. And around that star is a vast swarm of solid particles in a disk 40 billion miles in diameter. And some of those particles are probably planets. All of it about 50 light-years from Earth, way, way out there. My grandfather would say I should come get him, and we'd go out and look at the stars and stay up all night and talk. And I would go. and we'd go out and see Venus and Jupiter almost in conjunction with the bright star Lambda Sagittarii, the great winged horse of Pegasus riding high in the southwest sky, the misty patch of the Andromeda Galaxy almost overhead, and the Milky Way swung around since summer to run east and west. A shooting star would set my grandfather to talking about seeing Halley's Comet in 1910, and how that night of May 1819 he witnessed what was probably the largest simultaneously shared event in human history, and how the world was divided between those who celebrated and those who watched in fear and trembling. My grandfather would make me promise to watch the return of Halley's Comet the next time around on his behalf, and I would promise. Along toward dawn, we would talk of Orion, the great hunter, dominating the sky overhead, with the stars Betelgeuse and Bellatrix, the nebula in the belt, and Regal and Safe in the feet, pointing toward Sirius, the brightest star in the heavens. And we'd talk about how human beings have been looking at the very same stars and thinking the same things for so long, and how there must be life up there, same as here, and whatever it's like, it's looking at us. Do we shine? Are we part of some pattern in somebody else's night sky, a projection of their imagination and wonderings? My grandfather would say he was sure it was so. My grandfather would say we're part of something incredibly wonderful, more marvelous than we imagine or can imagine. My grandfather would say we ought to go out and look at it once in a while so we don't lose our place in it. And then my grandfather would go home to bed. You'd like my grandfather, and he'd like you, I think. Happy Grandfather's Day to him wherever he is, and if you see him, let him take you out to see the stars, and tell him I said I'd really like it if he came home for Christmas. I'm a little uncomfortable telling you about my grandfather, actually, and you might be a little confused by now. I certainly am. After hearing the preceding story, you might well wonder if the grandfather I'm talking about is real or not. What about the other grandfather, the one that got shot and the one who disappeared? Who is this other one? Well, it's the grandfather I imagine, remember? And I must answer that this grandfather both does and does not exist. It depends on what real is. I suppose it's harmless enough for a yearning to be so strong that what you need becomes very real in some corner of your heart. Picasso said everything you can imagine is real, and I understand that. My other grandfather is made of that cloth of yearning and imagination. And in a sense, you know, we make up all our relatives, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, and the rest, especially if they are dead or distant. We take what we know, which isn't ever the whole story, and we add it to what we wish and need, and stitch it together into some kind of family quilt to wrap up in on our mental couch. I recently spoke separately with 7 members of the same family about the same relative, and the stories did not agree, not even close. Memories are creative, and there is always the conflicting truth of many witnesses, always. We even make ourselves up, fusing what we are with what we wish into what we must become. I'm not sure why it must be so, but it is. It helps to know this, to keep it in mind. Here's the good part for me. Thinking about the grandfather I wish I had prepared me for the grandfather I wish to be and am becoming. It is a way of using what I am to shape the best I might be. It is a preparation. When I first wrote these grandfather stories, I was not a grandfather. Now I am, 7 times over. And the reality of my grandfather stories has shifted from the grandfather I wanted to have to the grandfather I have become. I have lived my way into the truth of my stories. And just recently, as late as last night, I showed these stories to a 14-year-old granddaughter and said, "What do you think?" And much to my absolute delight, she said, "Pop, that's you." So here's an example of what I mean. The grandfather in this story is the one I want to be and may become. My grandfather called me up last Tuesday to ask me if I'd take him to a football game. Grandfather likes small-town high school football, and even better is the eight-man ball played by Crossroads teams. These are from really small towns. Grandfather is a fan of amateurs and small scale. Some people are concerned about how it is that good things happen to bad people, and there are those who are concerned about how bad things happen to good people, but my grandfather is interested in those times when miracles happen to ordinary people. Here again, he likes small scale. When a nothing team full of nothing kids from a nothing town rises up with nothing to lose against some upmarket suburban outfit with new uniforms and starts chunking Hail Mary bombs from their own goal line and their scrawny freshman tight end catches three in a row to win the game, well, it does your heart good. Miracles do happen. Murphy's Law does not always hold, says Grandfather. Every once in a while, the fundamental laws of the universe seem to be momentarily suspended, and not only does everything go right, nothing seems to be able to keep it from going right. It's not always something as dramatic as the long bomb or the slam dunk that wins ball games. There are much smaller playing fields in life. Here's some examples. Ever drop a glass in the sink when you're washing dishes and have it bounce 9 times and not break, not even chip? Ever come out after work to find your lights have been on all day and your battery's dead, but you're parked on a hill and you let your old hoopy roll and it fires the first time you pop the clutch and off you roar with a high heart? Ever pull out that drawer in your desk that has a 10-year accumulation of junk in it, pull it too far and too fast, and just as it's about to vomit its entire contents all over the room, you get a knee under it and stagger back, hopping on one foot, doing a balancing act like the great zucchini, and you don't drop it? A near miss at an intersection? The glass of knocked-over milk that waltzes across the table but doesn't spill? The deposit that beat your rubber check to the bank because there was a holiday you forgot about. The lump in your breast that turned out to be absolutely benign. The heart attack that turned out to be just gas. Picking the right lane for once in a traffic jam. Opening the door of your car with a coat hanger through the wing window on the first try. And on and on and on. You've got your own list, I bet. We could probably have a conversation about this for hours. When small miracles occur for ordinary people, day by ordinary day, when not only did the worst not happen, but you got the gift of what could never happen but did, how grand to beat the odds for a change. My grandfather says he blesses God for each day when he takes himself off to bed, having eaten and not having been eaten once again. I know his prayer. Now I lay me down to sleep in the peace of amateurs, for whom so many little blessings flow. I thank you, God, for what went right. Amen. Here's a Wiggy speculation on an unknown grandfather. Mary's dad. I wonder about Jesus' maternal grandfather, Mary's dad. He's never mentioned, but he must have existed. Whatever your theological position, the Bible was peopled with human beings just like the rest of us. Mary had a dad. Imagine, Mary's dad comes home from work one day. His wife and his teenage daughter are sitting at the kitchen table. His wife looks grim. The very air of the room feels heavy. Mary has her head in her arms, weeping. "Welcome home, Daddy." "So," he says. "She's pregnant," moans the wife. "So, Joseph, I suppose. They are betrothed, after all." "Oh, no," that would be too easy. Your daughter doesn't do easy. Who then? She says, I swear to God, she says, get this, an angel of the Lord came to me in the night. She claims a guy wearing feathers snuck into her room and did what he did. Right. Not only that, she says the baby's real father is God. Right. What do you mean, right? Did you hear what I said? Actually, no. The father has not really been paying attention. This day-in crisis reporting happens all the time. He comes home, tired from work. His wife and daughter are having a scene in the kitchen. She said this. She did that. I did not. Yes, you did. Yada, 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 yada. Suddenly, the father's brain recognizes what his ears have heard. What the hell did you say? And it wasn't the last time he said that. For years afterward, it was the same. Jesus' maternal grandfather would come home from work. His wife would be waiting. Well, Grandpa, guess what he did today, your grandson? Water into wine, walking on water, loaves and fishes, healing here, healing there, and all the rest, yada, yada, yada. It must have been hard for that old man to sit quietly by while the rest of his friends bragged about their grandchildren. That's nothing, he would say. Wait till you hear this. You won't believe it. And they never did. I can testify on this score. Nobody ever believes what a grandfather says about his grandchildren. Nobody even wants to know, really. And it must be even worse if you claim your grandson is the anointed one and the Son of God who yesterday walked on water. Oh, sure. Right. One last grandfather story. A summer's evening, the front porch of grandfather's farmhouse. By the light of an aged and sputtering lantern, I am playing a cutthroat game of old maid with five card sharks under the age of 10. My grandchildren, neighbors, kids, and their friends. I am the babysitter from my point of view and the latest sucker to play cards with them as they see it. We are eating popcorn laced with grape jelly and knocking back straight shots of milk right out of the carton, which is being solemnly passed from hand to hand. We are all wearing cowboy hats, chewing on kitchen matches, picking our teeth. That's the rule. Hats and toothpicks. You must look serious when you play cards. And these are hardcore bull goose card whippers, you can believe it. I have been the old maid 3 times running, and I am down to 9 M&Ms and 4 pennies in my pot. And we, of course, are all cheating every chance we get. One of them has an extra deck and is passing cards under the table. I can't prove it, but that's what I think. Anyhow, what saved me from utter ruin at the hands of this criminal element were moths. A flock of moths were corkscrewing around the Coleman lantern, and every once in a while one would hit the hot spot and go zsh and spin out and crash like a fighter plane in a bad combat movie. Finally, one zerked out of orbit into the nearest spider's web, and the spider mugged, rolled, wrapped, and sucked the life juice out of this poor moth so fast and so mercilessly it stopped the old maid game dead. A Green Beret ranger could learn something about the garrote from this 8-legged acrobat with the poisoned mouth. And the kids loved it. Encouraged by this homicidal scene, one of the boys leaves the table, rolls up a sheet of newspaper, and starts a King Hell massacre on the rest of the circling moths, knocking them out of the air like a heavy hitter at batting practice, and then smashing them flat on the table, leaving little furry smudges and broken parts. I leapt to the defense of the moths. It's bad enough that the lantern hypnotizes them into kamikaze runs and that spiders zap them into lunch meat, but small boys with newspapers are excessive handicaps to have to overcome. Why are you killing the poor moths? Moths are bad, says he. Everybody knows that, shouts another. Sure, moths eat your clothes. I could not sway them. They were convinced. All moths are bad. All butterflies are good, period. Moths and butterflies are not the same thing. Moths sneak around in the dark, munching your sweater, and are ugly. Butterflies hang out with flowers in the daytime and are pretty. Never mind any facts of what silkworm moths are responsible for or what poisonous butterflies do. With a firmness that would have made John Calvin proud, moths were condemned now and forevermore Amen. Out of the mouths of babes may come gems of wisdom from time to time, but also a bunch of garbage. That ended the old maid game. I stomped off, telling them I wouldn't play cards with killers, and they shouted they wouldn't play with someone who ate all the grape jelly while nobody was looking. And I went to bed thinking, if the future is in the hands of maniacs like these little ones, we're in trouble. The next morning, the youngest kid came to me with a large, dead moth in one hand and a magnifying glass in the other. "Look," says he, "this moth looks like a little teddy bear with wings, and it has feathers on its head." "Wow. You like teddy bears?" I ask. "Yeah, I like teddy bears." "You like small flying teddy bears with feathers on their head?" "Yeah," he says, "I think I do." One must, sometimes at least, practice what one preacheth. And if one should look at moths without prejudice and with grace, one may be forced to reconsider small boys in a somewhat more generous light. Some moths can make silk. Some small boys can make sense. And know a tiny flying teddy bear when they see one. This next essay is called Near Death Experience. Now, it's said that people don't like to talk about death, but in just one afternoon, I heard people say, "Your mother will kill you if you wear that outside the house. Working overtime is murder. I laugh so hard I thought I'd die. My feet are killing me, and good luck, knock 'em dead." Perhaps it's just that my mental monitor has been tuned to notice these phrases because a friend and I have been talking a lot about near-death experiences. He's a physician and aware of how well-documented are the reports of those who believe they have died for a short time, crossed over into some other realm, and returned. Recently, his own heart failed during surgery, and in the moments when he was being revived, he had a classic near-death experience. Now, he's deeply mystified by what happened, and he doesn't know quite what to make of it. What is certain is the after-effect of the event. He's no longer afraid of death, for one thing, and he's living what many people would call a much higher quality of life, no longer so work-driven and in a hurry. He's moved from the fast lane to the slow lane of existence. His wife says a small dose of death greatly improved his life. Have you ever had a near-death experience? I have. Several times recently, actually. Not quite the same as my physician friend, but powerful enough to get my attention and make me think hard about life. This summer, for example, driving through Northern California, I noticed that a back door of my car was not completely closed. Took me about 15 seconds to pull over to the side of the road, lean over into the back seat, and slam the door shut. As I drove on, I rounded a curve to find that the driver of a small sports car had just shot through an intersection and hit an oncoming tractor-trailer truck so hard that he wedged his car underneath the truck, taking the top off the car and the driver. The impact jackknifed the truck into my lane. If I had not stopped for those few seconds to close my car door, I would have been part of a deadly accident. Toast. Another example, a week later, driving on across Nevada, I was a minute late on a curve where a huge tanker truck had lost its brakes, crossed my lane, and rolled over. If I hadn't taken time to wash my windshield in the last gas station, I'd have crashed into him head-on at a death-dealing high speed. I don't think I'm obsessing. I'm just noticing anew what's always so close by. I think of such things as I roll along in ease and comfort on a two-lane highway at 55 miles an hour, passing oncoming trucks and cars by about 3 feet, sometimes less, the slightest little twist of the wheel by me or the other driver, and my life is over. Flying along at 37,000 feet in a jet, looking down at the landscape, I press my nose against what looks like a very thin sheet of scratched plastic. There's a little space, and another very thin sheet of scratched plastic. And after that, there is only space, the air whipping by at 500 miles an hour at many degrees minus zero. If the little pieces of plastic fail, it's the end of me, sucked into oblivion through a very small hole, death by extrusion. In my travels, I have been to Gettysburg and Auschwitz and Hiroshima. I've stood in the very places where thousands died horrible deaths. Only the time frame was different. If I had been in the same place at that time, I would be where they are now, dead. Awake in bed last night, I watched the covers gently rise and fall as my sleeping wife breathed in and out. There was a slight pause at the top and bottom of the breathing. If it were not for the continuation of some unbelievably complex neurochemical reactions, each breath could be her last. I'm thinking that if her heart muscle does not squeeze again, our time together is finished. She breathed again, alive. I considered waking her up to tell her all this. She'd kill me if I did. So, do I believe in near-death experience? Yes, life is a near-death experience. The leading cause of death is life. Is there life after death? I'm dying to find out. Now, this is my essay on mushrooms. The first time was at Aunt Violet's apartment near Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., the summer I turned 13. I had come by train all the way from Waco, Texas, to visit the big city on the Potomac. And Aunt Violet was a hardcore social climber, a lovable eccentric, a heroine in an airplane crash, and an aspiring gourmet, and she thought my mother was a twit, all of which endeared my Aunt Violet to me. Aunt Violet and I got along just fine, thank you, until the night of the big dinner. The lineup that night included a senator, a couple of generals, and assorted foreigners with their assorted ladies, a very large deal indeed, for a kid from Waco, who had been upholstered for the occasion by Aunt Violet with a striped seersucker suit and a bow tie. Très chic. Glorious me. Anyhow, having asked if I could help with dinner, I was handed a paper bag and told to wash the contents and slice them salad thin. In the bag were mushrooms. Frilly-edged, mottled brown, diseased-looking, creepy things. Fungus. Now, I had seen mushrooms, and I knew where they grew, in dark, slimy places in the cow barn and the chicken yard at home. Once, some grew out of a pair of tennis shoes I had left in my gym locker over the summer, and fungus I knew because I had it between my toes from wearing those same tennis shoes every day for a year. But it had never occurred to me to handle mushrooms, much less wash and slice and eat them. My father told me Washington was a strange and wicked place, and now I understood exactly what he meant. So I quietly put the whole bag down the trash chute, thinking it was a joke on the country boy come to the city. I guess they must have been some mushrooms, considering how old Auntie Violet carried on when she found out. To this day, I'm convinced that's why she left me out of her will when she died. I clearly had no class. I confess that I still regard mushrooms and mushroom eaters with a good deal of suspicion. Oh, I've acquired the necessary veneer of pretentious sophistication, all right, enough to eat the things when invited out and to keep my opinions to myself. So I'm cool and all about mushrooms, but I still don't understand about mushrooms and mushroom eaters, not entirely, anyhow. In fact, come to think of it, there are a whole lot of things I don't understand about entirely. Some large, some small. I keep a list, actually, and the list gets longer and longer as I get older and older. For example, Here are a few mysteries I added this year. Why are grocery carts made with one wheel that has a mind of its own and runs cockeyed to the other three? And why can't you figure out which one that is when you're pushing it? Why do so many people close their eyes when they brush their teeth? Why do people believe that pushing an elevator button several times will make the car come quicker? Hors d'oeuvres, hors d'oeuvres. Why can't we just spell it hors d'oeuvres, O-R-D-E-R-V-E-S, and get it over with? Especially now, since we're feeling anti-French. Let's do this. Why do people drop a letter in the mailbox and then open the lid again to see if it really went down? Why are there zebras? Why do people put milk cartons back in the fridge with just a tiny bit of milk left in the bottom? Why aren't there any traditional Halloween carols? Why does every tree seem to have some old stubborn leaf that just won't let go? Is the recent marketing of cologne for dogs a sign of anything? Now I know these aren't what you'd call industrial-strength mysteries. All the big-ticket things I don't understand are at the beginning of the list and have been there for a long time. Things like electricity and how homing pigeons do what they do and why you can't get to the end of rainbows and even further up toward the beginning of the list of things I don't understand are the real big ones, like why people laugh and what art is really for and why God doesn't fix some things or finish the job he started. And at the top of the list is why is there life anyway and how come I have to die. Which brings me back to the subject of mushrooms. They were in this salad I was served for New Year's dinner, and I got to wondering about mushrooms again. So I got out the encyclopedia and read up on them a little. Fungi, they are. The fruiting body, the sporophore of fungi. The dark underworld of living things, part of death, disease, decay, rot. Things that make their way in the world by feeding upon decaying matter. Yeast, smuts, mildews, molds, mushrooms. Maybe 100,000 different kinds, maybe more. Nobody knows for sure. They're everywhere. In the soil, the air, in lakes, seas, river, rain, in food and clothing. Inside you and me and everybody else. Doing their thing. Without fungi, there's no loaf of bread, or jug of wine, or even thou. Bread, wine, cheese, beer, good company, rare steaks, fine cigars, all moldy. The fungi, says the big book, are responsible for the disintegration of organic matter and the release into the soil or atmosphere of the carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus that would forever be locked up in dead plants and animals and all people as well. Fungi, midwives between death and life and death and life again and again and yet again. There is a terrible and wondrous truth being worked out here, namely, that all things live only if something else is cleared out of the path to make way. No death, no life, no exceptions. Things must come and go. People, years, ideas, everything. The wheel turns and the old is cleared away as fodder for the new. So I picked at the mushrooms in that New Year's salad and ate them with respect, if not enthusiasm, wondering at what is going and what is coming, quietly awed into silence by what I know but cannot always express. Born by grace, downstream into the great pool of the way it is. I'm very involved in partisan politics, but I don't write about that in my books. This essay called Term Limits is as close as I've come. Notice, your citizenship has expired.
What?
Yes, term limits for citizens. Why not? This term limits thing is still a good idea. If it is true that elected officials get corrupted if they stay in office too long, maybe it's the same for us who hold the political office of citizen. Let's at least set tough standards for all incumbents, citizens included. Suppose that every 12 years our terms expired. Before we could requalify as citizens, our records in office would be judged. Remember, most of us got something for nothing the first time just by showing up here at birth. Now, we have to qualify. It's put up or shut up. Let's use the same standards already set for any foreigner who wishes to become a citizen of the United States. As I'm reading to you in early 2003, the standards are being rewritten and raised, but in a nutshell, here are the basic qualifications. First, you have to demonstrate competency in reading, writing, speaking, and understanding the English language. Already a bunch of us are in trouble, ain't we? The government also wants a recent photograph. Most of my friends are old, ugly, and irritable. If looks count, they're out. Now, I pause here, realizing that I'm both being literal and sarcastic. I trust you can tell the difference. But having recently worked through the citizenship process with a by-marriage relative, I can tell you that many of the most disconcerting questions are taken from actual government documents. They seem sarcastic, but they're real. To continue, you have to pass a physical exam. No TB, HIV, STD, or mental illness. You can't get in if you've got that. And all this qualifying costs money. Application fees and lawyer fees and doctor fees and notary fees. Proving financial support is essential. Somebody must be able to support you. The government wants to be able to seize somebody's bank account for non-payment of obligations. This is true. It seems that we no longer fling wide our doors to the tired, the poor, or the huddled masses. And remember, all you had to do was to get born here. Next, there are some, quote, additional eligibility factors, unquote. Ever been a communist? A Nazi? A terrorist? Persecuted anyone because of race, religion, national origin, or political opinion? Ever failed to pay your taxes anywhere? Been a habitual drunkard? Advocated or participated in illegal gambling? Got a criminal record? If you answer yes to any of those questions when you apply, we don't want you. This is true. Next, you must appear in person at the office of the INS and take written and oral tests to demonstrate your working knowledge of the history, the principles, and the form of government of the United States. Now, I haven't taken the actual written test, the one that's current, but here's the flavor of what might reasonably be asked. Explain capitalism. Distinguish between Democrats and the Republicans. Define liberal. Define conservative. Did Betsy Ross really make the first flag? Who coined the slogan, America, love it or leave it? What rights are in the Bill of Rights, and whose rights are they? Is there a Bill of Responsibilities? Add questions about current world affairs, local and state issues, and economics. Name those who represent you in local and state government. Bad news. Most of us wouldn't pass. We'd have to go back for 6 weeks to a high school civics class. Finally, we're required to take an oath of allegiance in court. We must declare that we will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies. Fight if called on to fight. Work for the common good. Everybody, not just those who volunteer for military service. What? I thought citizens in a democracy did or didn't do what they damned well please. It's a free country, right? Wrong. About half the people I know who are Americans wouldn't qualify for citizenship based on this kind of test. Besides not getting passing scores on the exam, some people haven't participated in elections for a long time, except to bark and bleed and moan a little louder just before the second Tuesday in November every year. As for taking oaths, most of the people I know would swear to Almighty God that the problem with this country is all those lazy, stupid, double-talking chowderheads who are running the government. It's the rage. Term limits, damn right. Throw the rascals out. But are we any better than the rascals we throw in? I say, let's find out. I say, tough standards for all elected and non-elected officials of